relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
This is America First, and here's your host, Dr. Sebastian Gorka.
Yes, this is America First, and if you're of a certain vintage and hung out in the, well, let's just say over the pond in a certain era, you'll know exactly what that music is. It brings a wry smile to our faces. To me, your host, Sebastian Gorka, and our very special guest for One-on-One, none other than the former Secretary for Veterans Affairs in the Trump administration, Robert Wilkie. Welcome in studio.
Do you know that show, Doctor Who? Premiered the day Kennedy was assassinated.
Yes, the first black and white episode, which was shot live, like you're bumping into the, you know, the furniture, aired on the day of the assassination.
That's right. And you look at the biographies of the first three doctors and their military accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. Army, Navy.
Number two commanded a minesweeper at D-Day.
Yeah.
Pertwee, number three, the crew of the HMS Hood.
Yes.
And Hartnell, I believe, was a pre-OW.
I think he was also a sergeant in the Army.
Yes.
And until Doctor Who, he was always being cast
as a sergeant.
As the craft sergeant in the Army.
Right, that's right.
Okay, well, we're so delighted to have you in studio. We're going to talk geopolitics. We're going to talk Russia, China. But first, there's a reason I played that music, because we divined very early on that we have a connection. I want to talk about your incredible military history before you served this nation as a civilian in the Defense Department and then as Secretary in the Veterans Affairs Administration. But explain to our listeners, our millions of listeners across the nation, why on earth an American knows so much about British pop culture?
Well, I was fortunate, and it was fortune that came out of hard times. My father was badly, badly wounded in the invasion of Cambodia. And the only thing that kept him in the Army was the good graces of a great general, Creighton Abrams, who said, no, we're going to overrule the medical board. We're going to give this officer 3 years to recover. And then if he can go back to Fort Bragg, we'll send him there. And as part of that recovery, he was sent to the United Kingdom, first as liaison officer at the Royal School of Artillery, and then to Aldershot, as he got healthier, to the 16th Para. And I was blessed to attend one of the great schools, the Cathedral School in Salisbury, in the Bishop's Palace. My study hall was in the room where Handel composed the Messiah.
Oh, my gosh.
One of the three copies of Magna Carta was something we saw every day when we went to sing in the cathedral. Eleanor of Aquitaine was kept in prison by her husband, Henry II, in what was our rugby field.
Oh, my gosh.
So the history was just dripping off of the walls. And you know, British popular culture, of course, animated much of America in the 1960s. But what struck me was how real the war was.
You mean in the minds of the British?
In the minds of people. And also tangibly, in that you could go to a city like Bath and look on that beautiful Georgian crescent and you see pockmarks all over.
Or Coventry,
right. and the cathedral that had been destroyed. And we were traveling in the summer and stopped in a town near Stoke. And the British major who was with us, we were on a bus with British officers and their families, said, Robert, do you see anything unusual about this town? No. So we're in the town square. He said, take a close look. What do you see? There are only women. He said, right. You don't see any men, do you? These are the daughters, the wives, the fiancés of men from local regiment wiped out at the Somme.
Oh, my gosh.
All killed. And they never left. Those women never left that town. Our only experience with that is the Civil War.
Yeah.
But that was so real to them. And you see the price. You see the price of appeasement. You see what it takes to recover from cataclysmic political mistakes. Because the price is paid in human beings. And to see those women walking, in that case, 60 years after the war, a little less, actually less than 60 years, was something that opened my eyes.
We are speaking on the anniversary this week of the death of Winston Churchill.
Right.
Will you talk to us? Because I find this creeps out in our discussions of current national security issues. With your unique experience in the UK across various, you know, military bases, with your father's history, your own history, growing up around Fort Bragg, how important is that? And I think of Churchill, you know, a man who represented service to the nation. Will you discuss something that is oft forgotten? It is an intangible, it is a spiritual wisp, if you will. But the esprit de corps and the importance of tradition amongst fighting men that you witnessed in the UK back then, sure, and that created what we have in Bragg and across the nation, which is under threat today.
It is under threat because that fighting spirit is considered by the left to be indicative of everything that is wrong with the United States, a patrimony, the left uses the words toxic masculinity.
Yes.
And yet, as your friend Orwell said, we sleep soundly at night because rough men break down doors.
Yeah.
And the traditions that bound the regimental system in Britain lasted through the ages. As a child, to walk into the dining hall at the artillery school, and there are murals of Waterloo and a room named after Britain's greatest military strategist of World War II, Alan Brooke, who had been the commandant of the School of Artillery. It brings home a continuum of Western sacrifice and Western tradition that is lost today. And it's a continuum that actually begins in Jerusalem, goes through Athens to Rome, to London and to our country. And then Churchill, I'll just say Nixon, in probably the greatest compliment anyone has ever given to another, called Churchill the largest human being of the 20th century.
The savior of the West. That's not an exaggeration.
No.
The man who rallied Western civilization to save itself from itself.
And people don't remember how close Britain was to conceding.
Yeah.
The king and Chamberlain had a choice. They could have gone with Halifax, who was the
Lord
safe
Halifax.
Choice.
Yep.
He'd gone to all the rules. He was a Cambridge Don. Establishment 100%. Or they could go with the people's choice.
Who, we must remind everybody, had spent a decade in the wilderness and been treated as a pariah because he warned his fellow Brits of the threat of Adolf Hitler, the jumped-up corporal.
And to tell you about how our societies have changed, it really was the mainstream British press that started asking the questions in the late 1930s, and you would see billboards appear on Piccadilly and on the Strand from the Mail, the Standard, what price Churchill?
Mm.
What price Churchill? And, of course, the rest is history. On May 10th, 1940, the king called for Churchill. You and I have talked about this before, to be around visionaries and to read about them. And the day that Pearl Harbor is attacked, Lord Mountbatten, who is at that time the head of Special Operations, their version of what we would have the Special Operations Command. I forget what they called it. Comes to him and says, "Prime Minister, Pearl Harbor has been attacked." And Churchill looks up and he says, "We've won after all." Because he knew that the limitless power of the United States was now engaged.
And one thing I'd love to remind my fellow Americans of, by the way, his mother was American.
And I like to say that at my school in Britain, that your greatest man was half an American.
We're talking to Secretary Robert Wilkie, distinguished senior fellow at the Conservative Mothership, the Heritage Foundation. If you enjoy these discussions as much as we enjoy having them, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and you'll never miss a single one of them. It's My Name's Sebastian Gorka, America First. Go to Spotify, subscribe today, share the news, share the word, write us a review, and you'll never miss a nanosecond. We've all been there. You get out of the shower, out of the bath, reach for the towel, and it's like sanding yourself down with a piece of cardboard. Why? Mike Lindell worked it out. They were importing towels from abroad, adding softness, and when you get home, it's just a con. Do what we've done. Order the incredible new MyPillow towels made with American cotton right here in the United States. Soft and absorbent as long as you own them. The six-piece set, two bath towels, two hand towels, two washcloths, regularly $109.99. You gonna get them for $39.99. If you use my name, go to MyPillow.com, click on the new radio list of specials for deep, deep discounts with promo code G-O-R-K-A. You've never tried a towel like it. 1-800-829-8468. 1-800-829-8468. MyPillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A. If you've had enough of the COVID blues, if you want to get out, if you want to travel, you've had enough of the lockdowns, will you join me and my good friend Dinesh D'Souza for the trip of a lifetime? We are traveling to the Holy Land for our Stand With Israel tour this November. We can walk where our Lord and Savior walked the earth. Even if you've been to Israel, you've never been with me and Dinesh. And if you've never been, now is the time. We're going to go to all the key sites you've read about in the Gospels, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the Holy Church of the Sepulchre, the Sea of Galilee. You do not want to miss this opportunity. Book today. Call 855-565-5519 or just go to standwithisraeltour.com. That's standwithisraeltour.com, 855-565-5519. Secretary Wilkie, I just want to talk geopolitics with you, history, British-U.S. relations, but I cannot but exploit this opportunity to discuss the incredible, I think just record-breaking things you did as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, because I've lived in America for 13 years. I've been a citizen since 2012. And for me, and I think for most, the conventional wisdom was, okay, that's it. VA is broke, unfixable. You fixed it. Talk to us about the mission you were given by President Trump, how daunting it must have been, and how you were given free rein, and how you solved it.
Well, that was the key. The President of the United States gave me his total support. He said, if you have to break glass, but do everything you can to turn this around. And we stepped on a lot of toes.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
When you were tapped for that, yeah. Did you have a sleepless night thinking, this is the Sisyphean task? I'm rolling a boulder uphill.
That's right. I'm not a doctor, never played one on television. And, you know, that was actually the key, because I didn't go in thinking, well, I'm going to start sending out medical missives from the 10th floor of the VA building. I'm not trained for that. My job from President Trump was to turn the ship, not to get into the weeds on medical care.
Yeah.
So what we did was we put people in place who had military experience. In the past, these positions were filled by people who wanted a fancy title on the resume.
So lifelong bureaucrats.
Cheap political appointees.
Oh, okay. They wanted to tick a box.
Yeah, tick a box. And that's a bipartisan comment in many respects, but certainly during Obama-Biden, it rose to a level that was just obscene. And that's why you got waiting times of years, but dead veterans in the halls at places like Phoenix. President Trump gave me the authority to dismiss people, over 8,000.
Wow.
When they said it couldn't be done. I walked the post. I hit every state. And you would be shocked, coming from a military background. I would arrive in cities as large as San Antonio. San Antonio is the 10th largest city in this country. And people would look at me and say, "You're the first secretary we've ever seen."
Oh, my gosh.
And that was the key. Now, the other part of this was, what was the philosophy? Is the institution at the center of a veteran's health, or is the veteran the center of the veteran's health? And there are only two ways to go. If the institution's the most important thing, then you have Obama, Biden. If the veteran's the most important thing, then you have Trump, Pence. We started sending veterans into the private sector. The first 6 months that we did this before the epidemic took place, of the 9.5 million veterans, 3.5 million went into the private sector.
Wow.
They got to go get medical care close to their home.
Instead of waiting a year.
Instead of waiting.
And having to travel 50 miles.
Yes. So we, under Donald Trump, VA went from having a 37% approval rating, according to CNN, under Obama Biden. The day Trump left, 91%.
My gosh.
91%. And we went from dead last or second to last in terms of best places to work in government to number 5. And we're closing in on NASA. The other thing, real quick.
Yes.
We implemented a program that began, was the brainchild of the great Curtis LeMay. Now, how does America's foremost advocate of strategic air power impact VA? Quick. LeMay is made second commander of Strategic Air Command. The command doesn't work. He's got 1,200 planes. He said, "Let's kick the tires. Sortie the planes to 6 targets in Canada. Of the 1,200, 100 get off the ground. Of the 100, only 7 make it." There was a bloodletting of colonels, lieutenant colonels, and several generals, and LeMay said, "We've got to start over." But what he did, he instituted just leadership so that the squadron would meet on Monday. Not the pilots, just the pilots, but the maintainers, the food people, the logisticians, the weapons loaders, the intel guys, and they discuss what, not necessarily what went right the day before, but what went wrong.
So an all hands on what
all
went wrong.
All hands. That gave everyone a say. We implemented that at VA down to the custodial level, and morale went up. And counter to what popular Washington think is, by eliminating those 8,000 people, the folks we wanted to keep and nurture said, "Yeah, I don't have to carry the load for 3 guys who aren't carrying the load." And morale skyrocketed. And it really, and forget me, I just had great people, great soldiers and airmen to implement these programs. And the howls. I mean, I was viciously attacked by the Democrats in Congress, the leadership of the professional veterans, I call them, who don't represent really the rank and file. If the rank and file knew what they were doing, then they would. But just give you an example of how bad things are now. The one piece of veterans legislation the Pelosi House has passed has been legislation to remove Abraham Lincoln's name from the buildings of the Veterans Affairs Department and from our cemeteries.
Well, he's the best kind of guest, because that was going to be my next question. What's happened in the last year? He read my mind. It's not Doctor Who. It's Star Trek, and it's Vulcan, a mind meld. But you've answered the question. I wanted to know how bad it has changed in the last year, and that's absolutely shocking. Our guest is former Secretary of Veterans Affairs, former Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. You're listening to America First One-on-One, coming to you live from the ReliefFactor.com studios.
This is a red alert for hardworking Americans who are tired of seeing their freedoms and savings threatened by the globalist agenda. Wealth Protection Research is on a mission to find whistleblowers who are exposing the schemes that threaten your financial security. We're talking about real, patriotic financial warriors like Jim Rickards and Porter Stansberry. They're not afraid to tell it like it is, exposing how the system is rigged against you. Text IDEAS to 76626 to find out more. With the 2024 election storming our way, your IRA and your 401k appear to be in the crosshairs. That's why we've compiled our three favorite ideas from freethinkers. Don't wait for a knock on your door telling you it's too late. Get this critical report. Text IDEAS to 76626. The fight for your financial freedom is on. Text IDEAS to 76626 now for your free report. That's IDEAS to 76626. Standard text and data rates may apply.
Let me ask something I should have asked way back in the beginning, Secretary Wilkie. You have a stunning resume even before you rise to the heights of the DOD and to the cabinet of the Trump administration. How do you end up serving in two different services, the Air Force and the Naval Intelligence?
Let me take a step back. My military service compared to my ancestors is very modest. I mean, my father was a senior officer in the 82nd Airborne Division and an incredibly decorated combat soldier with 3 Purple Hearts, I think 8 Bronze Stars. And the people he served with were of that ilk. I'm just a staff officer. And I made a decision early in my life that I wouldn't be in national security unless I could serve in some capacity, because I saw, particularly in the NSC world and the State Department world, national defense being a game played by a Princeton debating society, where they looked at the folks at Fort Bragg as sort of a pin on a map to be toyed with.
A tool.
And there was not flesh and blood. I made a mistake when I was Assistant Secretary of Defense. I was getting out because I thought I was too busy. And that's how I went from the Navy. And I found the Air Force. It's been very interesting. It kept me grounded.
But it's an unusual career path, two services, two uniforms.
Yeah, it's not as unusual as you think when you look at the guard side of things.
Oh, okay.
People serving in the active forces, then going in the guard. Somebody like John Warner, the late chairman of the Armed Services Committee, was a sailor and then he was a Marine. So there's still a lot of that. Particularly in the younger years of military service. I want to go back at one thing that I cherish from my time in Britain. Because my father was the senior NATO officer at Larkhill, the tradition then was that when they would bring important figures from British military to Larkhill, in this case, the American officer would host. And there were 2 visitors to our home, and I would sit at the top of the stairs just to listen. One was Lieutenant General Sir Brian Horrocks, who, if any of you have seen the movie or read the book A Bridge Too Far, he's the commander of Guards Armor, the 30 Corps, who has to go up that little road, and a very flamboyant figure. And to listen to him talk about that, too, he knew my father's paratrooper pedigree. And then the other was a fellow named Sir Richard O'Connor. Richard O'Connor was the commander of the British Army in the desert. He destroyed the Italian army and would have pushed all the way to Benghazi, but was captured.
Mm.
The one German paratrooper unit that happened to be with us captured him. And he eventually escapes. He escapes and gets to Switzerland. And in the push to Germany, Montgomery has him as his senior corps commander. And to listen to him talk about the Italian campaign, and I can remember him saying that, you know, one Tommy would be hurting 1,000 Italian prisoners. And they were the British, the Tommies called the Italians the gentlemen. Here come the gentlemen.
The gentlemen.
Because they couldn't wait. They couldn't wait to get. So that was just an incredible experience.
It reminds me of my childhood as an only child. There were three steps down into our dining room, and my father would sit at the head of the table and regale our guests, our dinner guests, and I would sit at the top of those stairs as a child, just watching, not saying anything, just listening to these discussions of dissidents, people who'd escaped communist occupation or fascist occupation, and it definitely molds one for life. Dear friends, this program is not funded by the taxpayer. We don't get $500 million like NPR does for the propaganda they spew. This is a free market enterprise. As such, it doesn't happen without you supporting those who support us. You heard the audio. Mike Lindell's bank, the Heartland Financial in Minnesota, has shut down all 9 of his accounts, including his personal account, including the account for the foundation where he helps former drug addicts. Let's support him. The left wants to destroy him simply because he's a conservative. Use my name. Go to MyPillow.com. Buy whatever you want, and Mike will give you up to 66% off. Call 800-829-8468. That's 800-829-8468. MyPillow.com. Promo code Gawker. I've reserved one segment of our discussion to talk about active issues of the day. You had the position prior to becoming Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Secretary Wilkie, of being the Undersecretary of Defense for readiness, for personnel and readiness. What is your reaction to the state of readiness after 12 months of the Biden regime and the decision to deploy 9,000 warfighters to Europe to stop the Russians?
Well, it's not going to stop the Russians. It is the classic, let's engage in what I call performative diplomacy. Mm-hmm. The state of readiness is not good. And I'll focus on the United States Navy. The United States Navy continues to shrink. We have the smallest Navy since before Ronald Reagan. But the argument from the other side is, well, quantity is more important. I mean, quality is more important. Well, there comes a time when quantity overwhelms quality. And we are breaking the hulls on our ships.
Numbers has a quality all of itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We went away from what I would call fleet tactics in the Navy. We still haven't gotten back to that. And I'm very sorry to say this, and it's not meant to be derogatory. Our Navy has become essentially a transport service for the United States Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. We've lost our naval air capability for deep strike and reconnaissance, and we need to retool really fast. For the Air Force, the bureaucracy has completely muddled the pipeline for pilots. It's not an issue of Americans not wanting to fly. It's an issue of the Air Force being so bureaucratically sclerotic that they can't get pilots into the...
Will you explain what is going on?
Well, they boulderized the training squadrons. They decided, well, our senior leaders don't want to command training squadrons. And they got rid of a lot of the training billets that the Air Force had. So there's not enough training capacity for the pilots who are in the system. And that is particularly problematic, given, in my view, that the response to China is going to come from the air or from under the sea. And we need a robust air force. We need an expanding Air Force, but also an Air Force in space and cyber. As for the Army, I fear that the Army's physical readiness standards are continuing to erode, that they are playing the political game to the detriment of national security. I see the erosion of that martial spirit that you described, that had been the hallmark of the Anglo-American military tradition. Our officers spend too much time, our senior officers spend too much time in Washington. Brief history lesson. The Goldwater-Nichols was passed, I believe, in 1986. It was a response to the fiasco in Grenada, where the paratroopers on Grenada could not talk to the ships off the coast. The famous story about the young lieutenant having to use his credit card to call Fort Bragg, to Fort Bragg to call the Navy. I think the one hindrance, the one problematic change that Goldwater-Nichols wrote in was it mandated too much time in Washington.
Yes.
And not enough time with the troops. We need to go back to a couple of things. One, a hardcore regimental system where that soldier and that officer is identified with a unit. We need to keep people in place on post longer. Fort Bragg is the classic example of this, where you can have an entire career going from different ends of Ardennes Street to Corps headquarters to Force Comm headquarters.
Right.
We need people spending less time pouring martinis at the White House.
Yeah. Just to put a bow on that, there is much to be said for the theory as to why Mike Flynn, my friend and former White House colleague, had to be taken down by the deep state and by those politicized actors, even in uniform, because until he became, this is shocking, until he became the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Mike had never served in Washington, right, which is remarkable,
right,
which meant he was not a hostage, right, to those politicized interests in the deep state.
Right.
And to the SIS, to the SES, he was a threat.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not denigrating basic service in Washington.
No.
But what I am saying, when that becomes the centerpiece of your military career from the time you were a colonel,
yeah,
you lose your edge and you become hostage to all the emoluments that this town offers. You get to go to receptions. You're talking to ambassadors. And you lose touch with the ethos. I can make an argument from British history that the finest officers that Great Britain produced were the officers who manned, in World War II, who manned the Indian Army from Slim on down.
Slim.
Because
Viscount Slim.
They stayed away from Whitehall.
Yeah.
If you look at the miracles that those men wrought in that 14th Army...
There's a fabulous lecture. We'll post it on our Twitter feed right now about the American Ajax, Patton, the American Ajax, and where are those men today? It's by, of course, Victor Davis,
yes,
Hanson, a superb lecture. You're listening to One-on-One with me, Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump and with cabinet member to the Trump administration, Robert Wilkie, former Secretary of Veterans Affairs. You mentioned some amazing names, Robert, if I may, in the UK and elsewhere, and you mentioned the phrase of visionaries. We don't rehearse these questions, we don't give out talking points, but let me just throw this out there. Where are the visionaries, the Spikemans, the Mackinders, the Mahans. It sounds like I'm talking ancient history when I use the phrase strategic visionary in the 21st century. Why are we so devoid?
Well, I have an interesting take on that. And I had this conversation yesterday with some people you know, your wife knows. I won't name them, but they're in your business, her business. And we were talking about the paucity of really good national security strategic studies programs in the United States. Mm-hmm. And what did we mean by that? We meant programs that take a youngster or a young officer from Thucydides and Herodotus and Xenophon and take them all the way up to Mahan and Mackinder and Sir Julian Corbett, and even to our friend Victor Davis Hanson.
Yes.
We are no longer grounded in the, people are not grounded in the truths of Western military culture. And if you don't have that, it's very hard. It is very hard to look at the world and understand what motivates people. What are the tides of history? I mean, Churchill could look at a map and he could Nixon too. Nixon could look at a map and he knew what motivated people. Mm-hmm. What price are they willing to pay?
Well, and the three eternals from Thucydides, interest, fear, and honor.
And honor. Those things are not taught.
No. Or if they are, they're deemed to be
right.
Bad.
And military, professional military education, and I'm sorry to say this, I'm a graduate of the U.S. Army War College, in many respects, not all, has just become a box to check on mm-hmm. a career path. Mm-hmm. We need to get back to the days of Eisenhower, when someone like Eisenhower, in between his many different field assignments, was able to write and to think, and he had great teachers like Fox Connor and George Marshall. You know, Marshall picked Eisenhower, and to tell you what that was like, so Eisenhower reports a couple of days after Pearl Harbor. Marshall looks at him, he said, "Eisenhower, give me a plan for the Pacific. Now MacArthur's under siege. You've got 3 hours." And Ike gets to a typewriter. I think it's 7 pages. You can still see it in the archive, the War College archive. And there is the plan that eventually wins the war in the Pacific. And Marshall says, "General, I have a lot of officers who ask me to decide things. I want officers who tell me what I should be doing."
That reminds me, when I teach, I use a couple of quick case studies of getting things right. We've discussed offline NSC 68, the long telegram. There's another one that's lesser known. It's Major Wiedemeyer, who was tasked before Pearl Harbor as a major. He then, of course, made it up the ladder to general. If we go to war with Germany, how many troops will we need? And this major sitting there writes the V plan for a prospective war with the Third Reich. And he estimates 10 million GIs in uniform. Not bad. We eventually mobilized 12. But for a major before Pearl Harbor to work that out, how did he do that? Because he spoke German and he had attended the Kriegsakademie in Germany and dated the chief of the defense staff's daughter. And he knew the threat and he knew how to read a map. So, yes, it can be done and we need more of them. You mentioned what is our heritage? You mentioned this unbroken rope, this chain between Athens, Rome, London and America. Where do you stand with regards to our civilization? Are you an optimist, given what we've witnessed in the last...
Well, it's interesting because I spent, if I can use a family secret, I spent an hour and a half with your wife and some of her colleagues at Heritage talking about this very thing. I think we are on the precipice of losing that. And I just point to something recent, the destruction of the statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front of the Museum of Natural History. The House of Representatives voting to remove the sacral words of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. We are being led at the elementary level by people who cheer or pray for the end of the West. You see that in our education at the lowest levels. I think for the Biden administration, and I've written this, these are people who believe they exist to manage America's decline.
Correct.
And, you know, Harry Truman used to say, every opportunity, if you are not excited about our history, how can you defend the country? Mm-hmm. And here was a man who lied and cheated. It's a great story. Lied and cheated to get into the army. He memorized the eye chart.
The eye chart.
Because he could not abide the fact that his neighbors and friends would be going off to war without him to be there. You know, and Churchill always said we have to keep people excited about their history and their language, which is the great leveler.
And he wrote the history of the English-speaking world.
That's, right.
That's not an accident. Right. I always like to ask for our last question from our guests here on One-on-One. What is, let's give our listeners, our viewers across the nation, a little bit of homework. So given your proclivities, your interests, talk to us about things that our listeners should be paying more attention to, or what should they be reading? First things first, join the Heritage Foundation, where Secretary Wilkie is Senior Distinguished Fellow. Yeah. That's heritage.org. It is the conservative mothership. We are so excited that we will be having the new president on our show this weekend on Newsmax, so you mustn't miss that. But what would you say to those who enjoy this conversation and want more? Where should they begin?
Well, what they should do is embrace their history. There's never enough to read. If you want to know of our place, there's nothing better, and it's not a hard read, Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples, and its addendum by your friend Andrew Roberts, History of the English-Speaking Peoples since 1900. And you see that we are the heirs to the most benevolent imperium in the history of the world. We have given more to the world than any other civilization. And I say that the Anglo-American tradition, and I include our friends Australia, New Zealand, Canada. We are the freest people in history. I would also ask people to read extensively about the life of General Washington. That sounds sophomoric. Without Washington, there is nothing.
Yeah.
And Madison. I'm just going through a new wonderful biography of James Madison, America's first politician.
Do you have a recommendation on Washington? Where to begin?
Well, the best one is the longest one, and that's Douglas Freeman's biography of Washington. His six volumes condensed into one. There are several. There's a new one out, or by the University of Virginia history professor, I think it's Lengel, George Washington Revolutionary, and then one on George Washington Commander. Those books. But I will also add one more.
Mm-hmm.
I just read it. It's about David Reynolds, by a fellow named David Reynolds, and it's about 900 pages. But it is the complete picture of Abraham Lincoln and his culture. What made him tick? What around him animated his rise? How did he overcome a political society where he was the bumpkin, although he wanted you to feel that he was the bumpkin? So that's a magnificent work. And if you want to read about why I was so adamant in keeping Abraham Lincoln's words, not just for Lincoln, but for the power of the words, there's been a recent book called Every Drop of Blood, which is about the creation of that speech. Let me give you also talk about leadership and Obama taking a vote before the operation to get bin Laden was approved. There is a famous story about Lincoln taking a vote, and the cabinet consisted of six members. And Lincoln said, well, we need to vote. There's so much dissension here. Six votes nay, one vote aye. The ayes have it. And
that's superb. I think that's called the statecraft.
That's right. Lincoln was an incredible figure because he could remove himself from himself and look. And once you thought he was a bumpkin. Oh, one last. I'm sorry. Yes. One last. Written by a Rhodesian.
Oh.
Who didn't do as great a service to Ronald Reagan, Edmund Morris. But I think the finest biography that I've read in 40 years was The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt.
I know, because his Reagan work is...
No. But The Rise, not the other two Roosevelt books, but The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay.
And the power of this individual and his faith in the American nation.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the progressive side for a minute. But, I mean, as he got older, I think both Roosevelts and Wilson believed the Constitution was an inconvenience.
Yeah.
I think George Will said that many years ago, so I've appropriated it. That is a wonderful picture of America from the 1850s to the moment the ranger comes up the mountain with a piece of paper and Roosevelt knew McKinley was.
Well, that is a fabulous start to be getting on with. I think we have several thousand pages there of things to begin with. I've written them all down. They will be on my shopping list imminently as soon as we finish the show. I just want to, I think my listeners are going to agree. We have to make Secretary Wilkie a regular guest here in America First, and I hope he concurs. God bless you, my dear friend. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head on a swivel. Watch your six, hold the line, never give up, never give in, and stay frosty.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.